Is shut more? I can't get hard. Relax, he breathes, his thumbs running up the back of my neck. That feels too fucking good. He leans nearer to my body as his large hands travel down my build and then veer to my waist, teasing against the band of my drawstring pants. Don't fantasize. Don't fantasize. I breathe through my nose again. If I rotate and sit up, would we kiss? Stop thinking. When he leans closer again, I picture his lips beside my jaw, nipping my ear before sucking. Then I turn and we... No. Yes. Hell yes. I'm still lying on the ground. He's still massaging my tight shoulders that refuse to unwind. His lips do brush my ear, and he actually, realistically whispers, "Let go." I can't. The moment I let go, I'll cross a line that can't be crossed. He kneads my traps harder, deeper, almost bringing me somewhere I can't ignore, to a state of euphoria. My eyes open but nearly roll back, my mouth slightly agape. Fucking. I grab his wrist. Suddenly, instinctively, and he freezes, his palms on my lower back. Without releasing him, I use my other arm to prop my body. My chest rises in a heavy, ragged breath. I glance at him. Pharaoh breathes just as heavily, his eyes searching mine for reasons as to why I stopped him. I imagine shifting his hand lower, to my waistband, beneath the fabric. Do it. I blink once, remembering that Jane is here, and then I think, that shouldn't be the only reason why I stop. He's my fucking bodyguard. I let go of his wrist. The old love seat squeaks as Jane sits up.
I can leave you two alone if you'd like.
No, I say firmly and stare hard at Pharaoh, waiting for him to reject that offer with me. Pharaoh sweeps my body with a heady gaze, practically saying, I would have said yes. And then he stands up off of me. I have no real time to think. My phone rings on the coffee table. An incoming call. Not a text. I quickly stand and grab my phone. I see the caller ID, my little sister, and I become laser-eyed. Colossally focused. I concentrate on the here and now. Everything else behind me. I put the phone to my ear. Luna? Strange breathing filters through the speaker. I frown. Luna? Pharaoh stares far away like someone is speaking into his earpiece. He walks towards the front door. Jane springs to her feet and checks her cell for any texts or information. Luna, answer me. My cheekbones sharpen. I listen fixatedly, my grip tightened on the phone. She's never done this before. But she's also an oddball. You know Luna Hale is the 17-year-old alien devotee who posts inarticulate ramblings on Twitter and believes UFOs are real. You rudely nicknamed her secondhand embarrassment. Some of you even call her drunk when she's 100% sober, and you question the sanity of anyone who'd date her. I know her as my little sister, a girl who stays true to herself amid constant ridicule, someone I admire and love unconditionally. Fair warning. I'll kill you if you so much as breathe on her wrong. Simple as that. Over the phone, Luna sighs so softly. I almost miss the sound. Talk to me, sis. The call drops. What the fuck is going on? I turn to Janie. Did you text your brothers? Luna's best friends are two of Jane's younger brothers.
Oui.
Janie texts rapidly.
Elliot and Tom keep sending me devil emojis.
I shake my head, pissed. There are five Cobalt boys, and my little sister had to befriend the two that lit Jane's dollhouse on fire and laughed while it burned. They were 10 years old back then, but at 18 and 17, they still dance in chaos. By the door, Pharaoh speaks into his mic. Garage is full. You need to drop her off or park on the street. I can meet her at the car. Pharaoh gestures me over, but I'm already approaching him. My phone vibrates. A text. I'm on my way to you. Can't talk. Frowny face. Luna. Luna's on her way here, I tell Janie, who continues to text, and I stop only a foot from Pharaoh. What do you know? He clicks his mic and says to the security team, okay. His gaze clasps mine as he tells me, Luna asked her bodyguard to drive her here. She also requested that he remain inside his vehicle, which means she doesn't want him to overhear her, I finish, nodding to myself. Janie collects the rest of the facts.
She must be hiding something from her parents, and she's afraid her bodyguard will tattle.
He would. She's underage. It's not the first time my siblings have come to me. When they fuck up, my reaction is the lukewarm version of our overprotective dad. They say I go 3/4 Lauren Hale. Sometimes I think they test their wrongdoings out on me just to build the courage to confront him. Pharaoh looks at the outdoor security cams on his phone. When he catches me staring, I expect him to turn his back. Instead, he clasps my wrist and draws me to his side. Our shoulders almost touch. This is the street view, he says. The screen shows a few paparazzi loitering on the sidewalk. Pharaoh explains, when Luna's car reaches the curb, I'm going to open her car door and escort her into the house. I cross my arms and nod. I want to be the one to lead my sister safely inside my house, but I'd make the situation worse. With paparazzi constantly camped out, exiting my front door is like purposefully stomping on an anthill. Considering I'm deathly allergic to fire ants, that's not something I'd do. I typically just leave in a car, right through the garage. Jane pulls the coffee table to its original place.
Luna can spend the night. I'll make the bed in the guest room. We can even watch your favorite movie.
Janie tosses the decorative pillow on the love seat.
I haven't seen Guardians of the Galaxy in ages.
Yeah, I say dryly. How about we postpone baking my sister cookies and rolling out a fucking red carpet until we know what happened? She could have flunked 12th grade for all we know. Last week she had detention for vaping in the girls' bathroom. She's been apathetic towards school since the bullying started in kindergarten. I wish I'd been in her grade, so I could have been there more than I was. I could have stopped the harassment, somehow. But I'm 5 years older. By the time she hit freshman year, I was gone. Pharaoh clicks into another security camera. Jane nears us, her features soft and empathetic. She reaches out for my hand. I keep my arms crossed.
Mafi, she says tentatively. I know you'd rather believe Luna screwed up somehow because the alternative is painful, but you need to consider the other possibility.
That something bad could have happened to my sister, and she's coming to me for help. I lock all my emotion in an iron-tight trunk. Nothing crosses my face. I'm aware. Pharaoh scrutinizes me for a quick second, and then he hands me his phone. I'll be right back. He slips out the front door, kicks it closed, and nearly the exact moment a black Escalade pulls onto the curb. Declan would have never given me his phone. I realize that I can watch my sister from Pharaoh's cell. He knew I'd want to be outside with him, but to actually keep Luna safe from media attention, from rabid paparazzi, this is as close as I can get. And he gave me a better view than any bodyguard ever has.
9. Pharaoh Keen. Street lamps and rapid camera flashes illuminate the idling black Escalade. I tune out the security team in my ride ear, and I easily walk through the frenzied paparazzi. About 5 men swarm the car, pressing their lenses to the tinted windows. Others pace back and forth on the sidewalk and call their colleagues hurriedly. Get here now! We think it's a Hale kid, hopefully Xander! 2 men crowd the rear door, and I storm ahead. My threatening stride and appearance is like a gunshot. They stumble backwards, and I grip the handle to the Escalade. I mime opening the car door to rid the overzealous idiots. 1 man rushes up and knocks into my hard back. I shoot him a brief, scathing glare. Brief, because they don't need to think I care about them. Some paparazzi want to fight for footage or insurance payout. I hurt them, they sue. And then most hecklers want to fight for fame or because they're morons. And my job is to avoid confrontations, not start them. When I really open the door, I fit my body into the free space, not letting the cameramen see Luna yet. I'm not surprised by what I find. A gangly 17-year-old girl is sprawled on the leather seat like a starfish, and she's dressed in a full-body Spider-Man costume, mask and all. It's an easy ploy so people avoid snagging a money shot. She looks at me upside down. I won't smile during pandemonium, but Luna always manages to make life interesting. Out of all the Hale kids, I'd say I'm closest to her. For my 25th birthday, she wrote me an Avengers fanfic where Bucky Barnes and Captain America weren't merely just friends. It was entertaining as shit. Luna, you ready to go? I ask. The driver rotates. It's her 300-pound bodyguard who's been blowing my eardrum out for the past 10 minutes. I'm not close to anyone on Epsilon since the SFE lead calls me a liability, when really, he could audition for the role of Hall Monitor. Thankfully, her bodyguard isn't the lead of Epsilon. I dodged that headache. She won't talk, he snaps at me. She doesn't need to talk to climb out of a car. I extend my hand. She grabs hold, sitting up and sliding across the seat. Paparazzi scream.
Who is it? Who's in the car? Is that you, Xander?
As soon as she drops onto the cement and lets go of my hand, I slam the door shut. I push ahead to clear a path, and I make sure she stays right behind me. I keep an eye in front and constantly glance back at Luna. She's not one of the kids who fear the paparazzi. She seems fine, but with her Spider-Man costume hiding her face, it's hard to tell why she's here and what happened. When no more paparazzi lie ahead, I fall behind Luna and protect her from the back. We reach the brick stoop and the door already flies open. Maximoff pulls his little sister safely inside. Squatting down, I rummage through Maximoff's bathroom cupboard beneath the sink. I hit my elbow on the nearby toilet a few times. There's no space in here, not even for a tub, just a small shower stall. I push aside Jane's baskets of nail polish, and Maximoff bends down next to me and searches through the cupboard too. He has this intrinsic need to help, and he's been in Big Brother overprotective mode for the past 20 minutes. His love for his siblings toughens him, not softens. And a guy being so protective over the people he loves, I find extremely fucking sexy. I grab the first aid kit in the very back. The mouthwash needs to be alcohol-free, I tell him. And when he finds a bottle, we both stand up. I pop open the kit to see what else I need. Maximoff watches me. How up to date is your medical knowledge? I know more than you, I say, since he tried to diagnose Luna downstairs until I butted in. And I'm the one who graduated medical school at Yale. But your undergrad only took 2 years because I passed the requirements faster than the average person, Harvard dropout. Really? He deadpans. Maybe you just sucked. I roll my eyes and laugh. That's not how that works. I sift through the kit's items. Gloves, cotton balls, a plastic syringe, thermometer, but I'm still missing something. Pharaoh, he says nervously. If you're not sure, Maximoff, I look right at him. I'm 100% sure that she has an infection from a really shit tongue piercing. If you don't trust me, then go WebMD her symptoms. It'll tell you that I'm right. He cracks a knuckle. I trust you. I'm just, he gestures to his head, processing that my sister stuck a sewing needle in her tongue a week ago, and it's still bleeding and she may have a low-grade fever. You know, the usual Friday night. I take out my supplies and shut the first aid kit. It's a good Friday night when no one's crying or dead.
Which is exactly why she didn't want to tell my parents yet.
He rotates his stiff shoulders.
My dad will fucking die, and my mom will cry out of worry.
He keeps shaking his head, thinking about something else.
Fuck!
I need to make a saline solution, so take your fucks downstairs with me, Wolf Scout. He carries the mouthwash while I have the rest of the supplies. Once downstairs, we bypass the living room where Luna and Jane talk quietly on the love seat. Not even a foot into the kitchen, and Maximoff already fills a pot with water and sets it on the stove. I smile and place my supplies on the counter. He slides salt to me and ropes my gaze tenfold. You know saline solution is just distilled water and salt? I realize. Where'd you learn that? Wolf Scout training?
Common sense.
Who knew common sense could be so fucking attractive? The heat ratchets up. I end up saying, common sense is a good look on you. I pass him to grab a cup out of a cabinet and my shoulder slides against his bare skin. Barely any room for two bodies in this cramped kitchen. He tenses, breathing shallow, and he looks back at me. He's still only dressed in drawstring pants, his ass literal perfection in them. I've never wanted to touch, hold, and fuck someone as much as I want to touch, hold, and fuck him. And even though I just massaged Maximoff, it still feels like not enough. Not nearly enough. Still, he said no, and when a guy says no, I'm at full stop. Maximoff pours the distilled water into a glass, and I mix salt, and then I measure a small amount of mouthwash into another cup. Our biceps and forearms keep crossing and skimming. His breath audibly catches a few times, husky, and he clears his throat. My muscles burn. If he does that again, I may harden. What was eating at you from before? I ask, referring to his earlier exclamation of fuck. Maximoff glances at the archway, then to me. My little sister pierced her tongue, so I'm thinking about what other people think of tongue piercings and what they'll say about her, how it'll affect her, the media, and the subsequent headline, Luna Hale gets tongue piercing. She likes to give head. I can't say I'm surprised. We've officially established that you think way too much about what other people are thinking.
I have to, he refutes. People judge my family every damn day, and if there's any way I can save my siblings and cousins from harassment, then I'm taking it.
Using the syringe, I suck up the saline solution. His parents pay people to predict headlines, soften fallouts, and obsess so he doesn't have to. They're called publicists, but Moffy tries to be everything for everyone. The quality that I like best about him may also be his worst trait. He's too caring. Most likely, I say. Your sister isn't that worried about other people's judgment. Maximoff shakes his head, skeptical. Do you see me? I ask, motioning to my facial piercings. My left ear is also pierced, but I took out my earring last month for a change. And a barbell is hooked through my right nipple. Those of us who get piercings and tattoos generally don't give a flying shit what people think of said piercings and tattoos. Maximoff rests his elbow on the counter and faces me. Generally, most people aren't the kind of famous where internet trolls Photoshop your head on two humping rabbits. That happened to his mom, not Luna. Slowly, I put on the white latex gloves. You should remember that your sister is used to ridicule. He lets this sink in for a second. Luna isn't defenseless against cruel headlines. She has a bit of grit that her brother doesn't take into account. And realistically, I snap my last glove up to my wrist. She could have picked a tongue piercing with oral in mind. He grimaces. No. Little sisters can like giving blowjobs, I say and laugh as his scowl appears. Because you have so many little sisters. He knows that I have zero little sisters, zero brothers, and one much older stepsister. Sibling relationships are uncharted territory for me, but I like seeing his and how much they all mean to each other. It's endearing. Maximoff leans closer and lowers his voice.
As far as I know, she's never been kissed. He pauses, thinking. Wouldn't the security team know if she's been with anyone?
Epsilon would know, I correct. And if I radioed them to ask, they'd tell me to fuck off. I'm not interested in Luna's sexual history enough to extend an olive branch to SFE. On the list of important things, it's very, very low. While Moffy contemplates this, I shout, Luna! Spider-Man mask now off, Luna waves and trudges into the small kitchen, and Maximoff jumps on the counter by the toaster, sitting up high so she has room to stand next to me. Her features are a mix of her mom and dad, soft round face, amber eyes, and long light brown hair. Luna slurs a little as she says,
If I die from this, please tell the world that I got into a fight with a space alien, and the alien won.
Maximoff says certainly,
You're not dying, sis.
She takes a deep, relieved inhale, happy about being alive. I hand her the cup with mouthwash and saline solution mix. Swish and spit. Luna swishes and winces, and she tries to say damn it with a mouthful of salt water. Saliva drips down her chin. I guide her to the sink. Spit. She does, and bloody salt water hits the metal sink basin.
That stings so badly,
she breathes, clutching the edge of the sink. It's happening again, I warn her. Stick your tongue out. Luna winces already.
Right now?
She wipes her forehead with her arm. Her cheeks beat red. I need to take her temperature. Maximoff glares.
You plan on going somewhere, Luna? What else are we doing?
Jane promised a movie night, and we could always watch the movie then come back.
She shimmies her shoulders awkwardly.
Yeah?
She gives me a thumbs up. Stick your tongue out, I say. Luna frowns.
Moffy is supposed to be the hard ass.
I roll my eyes. I was a hard ass first, and then he copied me. Maximoff interjects.
Sounds like fan fiction.
Man, I was born before your parents even officially started dating. I give him a look. 5 years older, 10 times smarter. He shoots me a middle finger. I smile and focus on his sister. Luna. She reluctantly extends her tongue. Red streaks run from the silver ball to the tip of her tongue, a little swollen.
At least she bought an actual barbell. I leave the jewelry in place to avoid an infection closing inside the wound. Luna leans slightly over the sink and I use the syringe to wash near the piercing, places that just swishing wouldn't reach. When I finish, she spits into the sink again.
Done?
She asks. Not yet. I dunk a cotton ball in saline solution. Hold this against your tongue. She looks ashen, and her forehead glistens with a sheen of sweat. While I stick an ear thermometer in her right ear, I go over shit that I know. No kissing or oral sex until the infection is clear. She nods, but her brother cuts in.
Have you been kissed before?
No one said Maximoff Hale isn't just as blunt as me. Luna says,
Uh-huh.
What?
His jaw lowers.
By who?
She takes the cotton ball out of her mouth.
Guy at school? You don't know him. He bought me a sandwich afterwards.
She starts laughing at Maximoff's furrowed brows and hard confusion. You're totally fucking with me. He pauses. Right? I can't tell what's real or fiction with Luna Hale any more than he can. Luna just laughs again, followed by a wince. She touches her mouth.
Luna.
His edged voice deepens, more serious.
Why'd you even choose your tongue? You could have pierced your ear.
I already have pierced ears.
She rubs her arm across her sweaty forehead.
I just like how tongue piercings look, and I thought it'd be easy to do myself.
She glances between us.
Anyway, I heard it doesn't do much for pleasure.
It doesn't do a lot, Maximoff confirms, admitting to being sucked off by someone with a tongue piercing. I look at him. They have to be good at using the piercing for you to feel something. He licks his lips.
Experience, or are you just bullshitting?
My last ex-boyfriend had a tongue piercing. The thermometer beeps, filling a sudden dead silence. I take the thermometer out of her ear and read the temp. 101 Fahrenheit. Shit.
You have an ex?
Maximoff's voice is tight. I raise my brows at him and reach for my phone in my pocket. 4 exes. Long gone. I scroll through my list of contacts. Luna rests her elbows on the sink.
Mafif's never dated anyone.
The world knows that he doesn't publicly date, but I wasn't sure if he'd found a way to date privately in the past. You've never dated anyone? I ask, pausing on my phone.
No.
I can't help but smile. Your purity is showing. I return to my phone.
Pretty sure I've had more sex than you.
Luna seems unsurprised that he's had sex at all, and since he trusts his family, I'm sure he's less guarded around them. That's something neither of us knows for sure, Wolf Scout. I find the contact in my phone. And secondly, you don't win a prize for fucking around, just like I don't win one for being in relationships. Thirdly, you're still pure. He groans. I almost smile again, but I need to call someone that I'm not thrilled to call. Before Maximoff asks, I explain what I'm doing. Luna needs antibiotics. I can give her over-the-counter medication to combat the fever, but to get rid of the infection, she's going to need a prescription. He eyes my phone, and the contract screen says Dad. His gaze lifts to mine.
You're a doctor. Can't you just prescribe the meds yourself?
I never did my year internship, so I'm not medically licensed. I may have an MD beside my name, but it's practically useless without finishing my internship and taking a board.
Now you tell me.
I roll my eyes again. I know everything that a doctor does. I just can't do shit without being sued. Luna mumbles.
I'm gonna go lie down.
Maximoff concentrates on his sister. Stay with Janie just in case you need anything. Luna nods and puts the soaked cotton ball back on her tongue. Right when she leaves, Maximoff jumps to the floor and then takes my phone out of my hand.
It'll be faster if I call your dad, he says.
It reminds me that everyone, the entire security team and all of the families, know that I'm on the worst terms with my father. He accepted every single tattoo, every piercing, every means of self-expression. But the day that I quit medicine, he looked right at me in front of these famous families, in front of the giant security team on a hot Labor Day vacation, and he said loudly and clearly, "You're a disappointment." If I call him right now about medicine, there's a chance he may hang up on me. I nod to Maximoff and let him talk to my father. I stay during the conversation, but it lasts maybe 3 minutes, prescription ordered, and he hands back my phone. "You're in for the night?" I ask.
"Yeah."
"Okay. My ticket out of his townhouse has always been the information Price wanted, about the campaway event. I feel like my time is up and I have to board a train to an undesirable destination."
I'd rather stay here, but duty calls. I need to know your plans for December's charity camp away. Maximoff crosses his arms over his bare chest. You can tell the security team that the plans are the same except for the entry process. I shift my weight. What do you mean? There won't be hellishly expensive tickets to purchase in October. Instead, there'll be a raffle. A raffle? I repeat flatly. My team projected we'd earn $50 million with a camp away with either entry process, and I recognize the higher security risk with a raffle, but I want to give people who can't afford the tickets an opportunity to experience the event, he explains. So for every $1 donated, a person enters their name to the raffle. 1 week before the event in December, we'll randomly pick the attendees out of the pool. I cement in place. Basically, you're opening your 3-day camping trip to anyone who has a dollar. The public. I raise a hand, my pulse pounding against my throat. How many attendees will be chosen through the raffle? All of them. So, 300. 300. Security is going to have to background check 300 people in 7 days, and if anyone with malintent slips through the cracks, Maximoff will be put directly in harm's way. 10. Pharaoh Keen. Sweat dripping down my temples, I jab a red punching bag and finish my combination with the right hook and hard left kick. 4:23 a.m. Not even 5 hours after I radioed security about the raffle, Akara called a mandatory emergency Omega meeting at the Studio 9 gym. See, I recognize the danger of the raffle, but if I can't even convince Maximoff to let me drive his Audi, then I highly doubt anyone can convince him to alter a charity event that he's poured months and months of work and thought into. And I warned Maximoff that the entire security team would overreact about his campaway changes. He just said, I'll speak to the Triforce and comply wherever necessary, but the raffle is staying. Not many people ever volunteer to speak to all three lead bodyguards at once. Price Kepler of Alpha, Akara Kitsuan of Omega, and the bane of my career, Thatcher Moretti of Epsilon, are all at the peak of the security hierarchy, the Triforce. My gaze travels to the closed door. The silver plaque reads, Office. Maximoff has been in there with the Triforce for 15 minutes already. The three leads think they can further illuminate the risks to him, but Mafi contemplates too much. Whatever they have to tell him, he's definitely already considered. In short, they're wasting their time. I peel off my black boxing gloves, my chest rising and falling heavily. Three rows of red boxing bags line the right side of the gym where I stand. The left houses the boxing ring, racks of weights, and other gym equipment. There are only 5 bodyguards in Omega. We're all young compared to the other forces, and that's by design. The Hales, Meadows, and Cobalts hired us on to last a couple decades in this career, not just a couple years. Being closer in age to our clients, it's more likely we'll stick around for the long haul. While we wait for Akara to leave the office, the four of us squeeze in a workout, but we all slow around the 20-minute mark. Oscar tugs off his blue gloves, his damp, curly brown hair hanging over a bandana. You guys hear that Luna pierced an unmentionable place? I'm used to news traveling fast within the security team. Bodyguards gossip like family, but we never leak info to the public. Not even accidentally. Everyone's too careful. Quinn pauses his sit-ups on his punching bag. What? Like her? He gestures to his crotch. I roll my eyes and unravel my black hand wraps. Donnelly tosses his towel over his shoulder. Her clit? It's not a big bad word. Oscar butts in. Everyone lay off Quinn, all right? My little bro is young, impressionable, and still has his innocence and virtue, whereas the rest of us have lost our ever-loving minds. Quinn chucks his green boxing glove at his older brother, 10 years apart in age. Bro, I can say clit every day easily. Clit, 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 clit. We get it, I say, dropping my hand wraps on the mats. Quinn scratches his unshaven jaw, sweat built on his golden brown skin, and a tiny scar sits beneath his eye. Likewise, his nose is a little crooked from a short stint and bad blow in a pro boxing circuit. Oscar has similar lasting marks. Security jokes that no matter how many punches Oscar and Quinn have taken as pro boxers in the past, they'll always be handsome motherfuckers. I purposefully censored myself, Quinn clarifies. I wasn't about to mention a teenage girl's, you know. Clit? Donnelly says. Jelly bean, Oscar adds. Magic button, Donnelly smirks. Quinn shakes his head like we're all the fucked up ones. My brows spike. You're the ones who assume clitoris piercing at the word unmentionable. I tilt my head at him. And weren't you like a teenager like 1 year ago? Oscar and Donnelly laugh loudly, and Quinn gives me a faint death glare. He needs to work on his intimidation a bit. He's very green, brand new to security detail, and at 20, he's the youngest bodyguard in the whole team. If he screws up, that falls onto Omega's shoulders, but really, in a way on mine. Akara texts me every day. If Quinn needs anything, help him. Check in with Quinn. Keep Quinn in the loop. When I left Alpha and joined Omega, Akara told me straight up, don't go rogue on me. I need you to help with the new guy. Because I'm around Quinn as much as Maximoff hangs around Jane, which is literally every hour. Inadvertently, it's made me Quinn's unofficial mentor, and I'd never call myself a teacher. I like to do shit on my own. Oscar should fill this role, but the Oliveira brothers requested to be separated to avoid family infighting, probably because they almost stopped talking a few years ago when Oscar trained Quinn as a boxer. No one ever talks about the old rift. I can barely tell it existed. Quinn grabs a nearby water bottle. What did Luna really pierce then? I think belly button, Oscar says. Donnelly hangs onto his punching bag, a colorful tattoo sleeve covering his fair skin. He's a chestnut-haired, blue-eyed, shameless 26-year-old from South Philly. Real or rumor, Farrell? Why would you know? Quinn asks me like I've withheld information from him. Technically, I did. Because I'm closer to the Hales than all of you combined. They're each a 24/7 bodyguard to a Cobalt, and at the end of the day, we're all partisan to the families we protect. The Hales, Cobalts, and Meadows love one another to the very death, and they'd prefer that we love all three equally too. But spending day in, day out with one specific family, we grow attached. Oscar reties his bandana. You'll see, little bro. Soon you'll be taking European vacations with Jane and the rest of the Cobalt Empire, while Pharaoh here will be stuck at comic book conventions with the Geek Squad. I smile. You mean you'll be trapped on a private jet with 7 Cobalts, their mom and dad, and fast-paced banter that'll give you a permanent migraine 30,000 feet in the air? Donnelly points his water bottle at me. Poking at our lines then, Pharaoh, you're gonna get bit. My lips stretch wider. My allegiance is always clear. The Hales are known for being welcoming to oddballs and black sheep, very fandom-loving and all-around laid-back and cool. The first day I guarded Lily, she asked me, what house are you in? She meant a Harry Potter house. When I told her I'd never read the books, she bought all 7 for me and post-noted her favorite parts. The Hales are a bunch of dorks. For me, they're instantly lovable. But I respect the other families, too. The Cobalt Empire is the largest, known for their regal poise, intellectual prowess, and fierce commitment to one another. Each Cobalt is prideful and passionately unique, but when push comes to shove, they'll band together like an army of one. Quinn asks us, where do the Meadows go for family trips? Costa Rica, we all say together. Quinn chucks his other glove down the aisle of bags. Akara is one lucky bastard. Bodyguards vie to protect the 2 Meadows girls. The family of 4 is wild, adventurous, and they spend more than half the year outdoors. Since Akara protects Sullivan Meadows, the oldest daughter, he's backpacked around South America, swam with sharks in the Keys, and last summer, he was backstage when she won 4 Olympic golds for swimming. Donnelly nods to me. Real or rumor? You thought I forgot you didn't answer. Rumor, I tell him easily, having nothing to hide. The truth is better than letting security make far-fetched assumptions, so I add, she pierced her tongue, herself. Oscar rests an elbow on his bag, not at all caught off guard. His features say, I've seen everything. I'm unshakable. Epsilon shouldn't narc on the kids, he says. If she trusted her bodyguard, he could have taken her to a piercing shop without her parents knowing. That's allowed? Quinn asks, but no one answers that loaded question. Is it allowed? Not really, but the best bodyguards go to the grave for their clients. I will. I turn to Oscar. Luna's 18th birthday is in 3 months. If she wanted, she could have waited until November to get a professional to pierce her tongue. Oscar cocks his head. So piercing herself has nothing to do with secrecy? He raises his arms. Then why? Because she wanted to. I notice the office's doorknob slightly rotating. Donnelly lowers to the mats and sits against the bag. I must have been about her age when I pierced my cartilage myself. He wags his fingers. 4 safety pins. Oscar swigs his water. Using yourself as an example, Donnelly, goes on the con side automatically. Donnelly blows him a middle finger kiss. Finally, the office door opens and 4 men emerge. My gaze instantly hooks onto Maximov. He stands stoically, assuredly, not shrinking among the Triforce's authoritative presence. Damn. The corners of my mouth begin to lift, but they lower at one irritating thought. I'm not leaving with Maximov. Thatcher and Price said they'd escort Moffy to his townhouse. That way I could be a part of Omega's meeting. I'd rather be the one to lead him out. Maximov says goodbye to Akara. As Price and Thatcher walk ahead of Moffy towards the gym's exit, he abnormally hangs back for a second. His forest greens search the gym, and then they land on me. He was looking for me. My smile stretches, and my brows rise knowingly. He licks his lips and eyes my damp hair and black shirt that suctions to my muscles. He calls out, "Already beat after a 5-minute workout?" 20 minutes, I correct. "And never forget I last longer than you." Maximov touches his heart mockingly and then shoots me a middle finger on his exit. The door thuds closed behind him. Oscar rests his body weight on his bag, still staring at the exit. "Photos don't even do that guy justice." I rub my bottom lip, my piercing cold beneath my thumb. I've known Oscar as Bi since I met him at Yale. He was a science major too, only his focus was on kinesiology. So we shared a couple of the same courses, and on Friday nights we went to gay bars together because 1, Oscar is fun. 2, watching him hit on guys is amusing as shit. No one has simultaneously the best and worst pickup lines. I read into his words. "You think Moffy's hot?" "Everyone thinks Moffy's hot." Oscar rotates to me. "It'd be near impossible to find someone who says less than that. You see him? On a scale of 1 to 10, he's out of your league." I say matter-of-factly, trying not to appear territorial. My muscles contract, almost flexed, but Oscar can't tell. "More like he's way, way off limits." "Maybe." Akara approaches all 4 of us, standing well over 6 feet. "Hey, everyone, take a seat." Oscar and I lower to the mats where Donnelly and Quinn already sit. As soon as we're on the ground, Oscar sticks his hand into a Doritos bag. Shit, with Oliveira, could have packed a whole snack aisle in his gym bag. The guy is always hungry. "First things first, if you plan to recommend your gym buddies a security detail, ask where they're from. It's not that hard. Like this. Hey, Donnelly." "Hey, boss." "Where were you born and raised?" "South Philly." He pats his chest. "South" sounds like "Sow Philly" out of his mouth. Akara gestures to the Oliveira brothers. "Oscar and Quinn, where were you born and raised?" "Northeast Philly," they say with deep pride. Akara nods to me. "Northwest Philly, 2 streets over from you. We grew up in an affluent neighborhood and attended the same high school. Really, we were acquaintances. We became friends when Akara opened this gym, and I was one of the first to walk through the door." "See? Easy," Akara says right at Oscar, calling him out. "Triforce only hires new bodyguards who were born in Philly. They want people on the team who can navigate the city blindfolded." Oscar raises a hand. "I thought Reynolds was from here. He had that annoying South Philly lilt, sounded like Donnelly trying to order breakfast at Lucky's Diner. Kept saying Beggles and Wooter." We all laugh. Most everyone has a mild to no dialect, but the South Philly guys carry a much thicker Philly accent. "Again," Akara smiles. "Just ask where they're from. Saves me time." He finally takes a seat on the mats and closes the circle. Looking around to each of us, his lips fall in a serious line. "You're going to hate what I have to say about the charity event, but you get a grand total of 5 fucking minutes to complain. Then you're done. I don't want to hear anyone whining over the comms for the next 3 months. Don't be that guy." Quinn nods repeatedly. Akara should have been his mentor. I hang my arm casually on my knee. "Too bad Oscar's already that guy. Get back to me when you've been assigned to Charlie Cobalt. You'd start bitching if your client chose to experiment with hallucinogenics at a metal concert, and not even a day later he takes an 18-hour flight to volunteer for the Red Cross on another continent. I've never even seen him tired or even yawn." "I'm sure he's grown tired of you, Oliveira," I say. Everyone laughs again. Quinn nods to his older brother. "You shouldn't bitch about your client to Joe.
All yesterday, she said, I can protect Charlie better than Oscar.
Oscar sighs in annoyance. The younger sister, Joanna, isn't a part of security, and I've only met her once or twice around the gym. She just started boxing professionally this year, and the Oliveira brothers don't want her to quit. For as much as Oscar complains, there's no one that could do his job. Many have tried. He's tactically strategic and the perfect fit for Charlie Cobalt. It's why he's been on his detail for 3 years and counting. Akara snaps his fingers to his palm. Y'all ready for the news? Donnelly nods. Lay it on us. Akara starts. Mafi was really clear that he's not allowing any of his siblings or cousins under 18 to attend. Epsilon is out, Oscar says, since SFE protects the young kids. Akara shakes his head and pushes back his black hair. Most of them will be at the event for extra security. I stretch out my legs and bare feet, my muscles cramped. We've never needed extra security for the camp away, and that fact hoists dead silence in the air. We asked Mafi for more than 7 days to background check the attendees, which means that he'd have to close the raffle more than a week before the event. Akara mentions the largest point of contention for security. Mafi agreed to give us more time, but he printed out 12 pages of stats that Jane had calculated. I shake my head, my smile forming. Wolf Scout. I know what he did before Akara explains the rest. He predicted the profit loss for every extra week that we'd hypothetically close the raffle early. If we were to take 14 days to background check the attendees, the event would lose about 10 million. That's not a little sum of money. Their lives are priceless, Donnelly says. Did you tell them that? I did, Akara says to all of us, but you know Mafi. He's stubborn, Oscar says. Selfless, I add. HMC Philanthropies helps people. Quinn's brows knit together. Don't the families just contribute their wealth to the foundation? Raising more money is chump change in comparison. He could even cancel the event and it'd be fine. No, the rest of us say in unison. Akara leans toward Quinn. All of the HMC money is allocated to four areas. Education, environment, LGBTQ issues, and mental health. Within those categories, Mafi builds specific programs and initiatives, and not everyone is given the same sum. Some programs rely completely on these events. Like the camp away, I chime in. All of the earnings go to One More Day. Everyone knows the program Maximoff created. One More Day provides aid to low-income individuals in need of addiction rehab. Oscar swishes his water. Do we really want to deny people in need 10 million just to have an extra week to weed out the hecklers, glitter and flower bombers, possible murderers and rapists? Donnelly wants the extra week to ensure everyone's safety, but I'm ready to tackle murderers and rapists every day, every hour. Triforce already made a decision, Akara says, and we agreed to Mafi's terms, 7 days for a background check. Donnelly groans. Oscar curses. Quinn falls into deep contemplation. I'm smiling. Akara leans back on his hands. It's not the end of the fucking world. Any threats that get into the event, we'll detect and isolate there. The Hales, Cobalts, and Meadows trust us for a reason. We make few mistakes, and we never fail. Before they talked to Maximoff, the Triforce was adamant about changing the raffle. Now they're gleefully content with his plans. The guy has a way with people. I'm so impressed. My cock actually pulses. 11. Feral Keen. Declan left his replacement, which turned out to be me, a short note. I hadn't thought hard about Declan's words, his warning, until the end of September. Until today. Until Maximoff invited his three siblings and five of his cousins to mini-golf. Until everyone except Jane canceled when they saw social media, paparazzi and crowds amassed, jumping onto the putt-putt green like they caught sight of rock stars or English dignitary. And then Maximoff firmly and concisely said, we need to leave. We'd only been there for a half hour, and he'd spent the prior 3 hours coordinating the mini-golf outing for his family. Being forced to drop set plans that quickly would piss off most people. Maximoff just pivoted and created a new one in seconds. He signed the golf balls and putters for the mini-golf facility to sell, and then he spent the next hour taking selfies with fans and Jane. I spent that time detaching overwhelmed, sobbing girls and guys off his waist. When we finally climbed into his Audi, I expected Maximoff to sigh in exhaustion, maybe express frustration. His mom would have been tired, a little upset. Instead, he seemed just as prepared for anything. And he said, "Let's find a pub. Jane will meet us." Declan should have written, "Maximoff Hale will barrel through every circle of hell and come out unscathed." He actually wrote, "Everything in Moffy's life is short-lived." 9:12 p.m., we shake off paparazzi and discover a hole-in-the-wall Irish pub around South Philly. After I ensure the place is safe, we order our food and drinks at the bar. They say they'll bring it to us shortly. We claim a low wooden table in the very back. Cigarette smoke clouds the cramped, dimly lit area, and a soccer game airs on the only TV, engrossing several old bearded men at a high-top table, plus the bartender. I lean back on two legs of my chair and casually examine our surroundings, but I find myself looking at him. Maximoff reads a text. "Jane and Quinn are still 15 minutes away." I open my mouth to reply, but a voice infiltrates my right ear. "Omega to Pharaoh." I drop on all four legs of my chair and press my mic. "Pharaoh." My eyes lift to Maximoff, who watches intently, like he's never even overheard his old bodyguard speak to security before. Maybe he hasn't. I'm not about to excuse myself from the table to speak to Akara. I don't care if Moffy listens to a conversation that's about him. In fact, I pop my earpiece out, hang the cord over my shoulder, and then I swivel the volume knob on my radio, increasing the sound. His brows furrow, confused. My smile stretches. "Just wait, Wolf Scout." Akara's voice crackles over the earpiece speaker, audible to me and Maximoff. "I need to know if Moffy plans to go to a drugstore or grocery within the next week. We'll have to put extra security on him." With the Campaway approaching and its annual popularity, he's been in entertainment news almost nightly. "And?" I ask Maximoff. He knows that Akara can't hear me unless I touch the microphone. He leans forward, forearms on the table. "Tell him no." I click the mic. "No, not anytime soon," Akara says. "Thanks." The line goes quiet after that. Taking a deep breath, Moffy straightens up, and neither of us unfastens our strong gazes. "Did you like that?" I ask, my lips lifting. "So badly it hurts," he says dryly, but a real smile crests his mouth. "Would you be willing to do that for me all the time? Would you want me to?" I love giving him things that no one else can. For a guy who has the world at his fingertips, you'd think there's nothing left to offer Maximoff, but he's been denied some simple pleasures and human rights, like the ability to drive safely down a fucking highway. Maximoff cracks his knuckles. "Actually, no. Security will kill you." "Now you care if I die? What happened to shoving me out of the car and backing up over my body?" "Give me 5 minutes," Maximoff says. "We'll be back to your death." I roll my eyes into a wider smile, and my tattooed fingers rotate a salt shaker like it's a coin. I catch Maximoff staring at my fingers for two long beats. He's in love with my fingers. I try to seize his gaze. He purposefully glances behind me. I follow his attention to the bar, and I run my tongue over my molars, my smile slowing, hardening. A guy about my age sits on a tattered leather stool, dressed in a black beanie and graphic t-shirt. My jaw muscle twitches. I look between them, and the guy gives Maximoff a suggestive, "I want your ass once over." Maximoff begins to smile back. I can't tell if he's just being nice or if there's real interest. My narrowed gaze pings from him to the guy, my muscles burning the longer they scrutinize one another. I shouldn't care. I set my elbow to the table and put my hand to my mouth. I spin a salt shaker with my free fingers while a million replies grind at me. "He's not good enough for you. You could do better. You really like that dickhole? You're here with me. Don't flirt with him. Don't fuck him." The salt shaker falls on its side. Moffy glances at me while I upright the salt. Jealousy. I'm jealous of a nameless, beanie-wearing dickhole on a bar stool. My ex-boyfriends would laugh at me for caring this much about a 22-year-old celebrity. I unwrap a piece of gum, and as soon as I peel the foil, Maximoff asks, "What's your favorite color?" The corners of my mouth curve upward. "My favorite color?" I repeat, like he asked me a kindergarten question, which he did. But I keep thinking, he's not interested in that other guy anymore. He's more interested in me. Maximoff crosses his arms.
What kind of high school names someone valedictorian when they can't even answer their favorite color? I lean forward and whisper lowly, says someone who doesn't know what it's like to be valedictorian. Just admit it, he says. You don't have a favorite color. It's sad. It's silver, I retort. He nods a couple times, his own smile appearing, and just as he goes to speak, the waitress brings out two Fizz Lifes, a plate of loaded potato skins and a basket of French fries. He stares off for a long second, lost in his head. I wad a straw's paper and toss the tiny ball at his face. It hits him square in the forehead and he wakes up to glare at me. He asks, do you know mine? His favorite color. Orange. You actually Google searched me. He says it like he caught me jacking off. I almost laugh. Man, you have a mom who buys orange plastic silverware and plates for any Maximoff Hale-related event. I count off my fingers, starting with my thumb, which includes your 16th birthday party, your prep school graduation. All right, he cringes. You knew me when I was 16, I get it. The world gets it. The world doesn't care that I was at your 16th birthday. He flips me off with one hand and grabs a potato skin with his other. He gestures at me with the potato skin. Eat. Stop staring at me. Not until you admit that I know you better than a Google search. Maximoff pauses eating, just to quiz me. Why don't I date anymore, Farrell? That's not a fact available on the web, and it's also something he's kept private from me. You're not into relationships, I guess. Not because I wouldn't want to be. I just can't. I shake my head. I don't follow. I'll never be in a relationship, he tells me flat out. I'll never experience any kind of romance beyond a one-time hookup, because once I date someone in public, media will hound them to the point of intrusion, vulnerability. I won't ever subject someone to an extreme loss of privacy that they'll never get back. I've accepted that this is my life, and I'm satisfied with that. My brows ratchet up. You're not satisfied. You're just resigned. Before he protests, I ask, have you ever wondered what it's like to hold someone's hand romantically? To see them in your bed two nights in a row, cook breakfast the next day, share clothes, wake them up before work? You've never imagined that? Maximoff shakes his head once. I can't. That's sad, because he wants to desire those things, but he's not even allowing himself that. And no one else among the Hales, Cobalts, or Meadows would sacrifice the possibility of a relationship just to protect their significant other from the media. Only him. What about dating privately, I ask. No, if I can find someone to trust for longer than one night, they'll be all over the news every time I was spotted with them, especially if I let them meet my siblings. I'm the exception to that. Our eyes meet, and that fact passes between us. He clears his throat and reaches for his Fizz Life, the world's most popular diet soda. Give it here. I gesture for the glass. He has a rule about ordering drinks. Number 45. Sip all my drinks first. I don't trust bartenders. He slides over his Fizz Life and takes a moment to eat another potato skin. I swig his drink. No alcohol. It's good. I slide the Fizz Life back. Maximoff Hale doesn't drink alcohol. He never has. It's public knowledge that alcoholism runs in his family, and he chose to be sober. Bartenders sometimes purposefully spike his drink. Hell, some people pay the bartender to do it, just to see a celebrity break sobriety. Maximoff washes down his food with Fizz Life. Then he motions to me. What's your favorite childhood memory? I smile and eat a fry. What's with the 20 questions? You can Google me, I can't Google you. He wants to be on equal footing. Okay, I swig my own drink. My favorite childhood memory is the only memory I have of my mother. He's aware that she died from breast cancer when I was 4. Maximoff holds my gaze strongly. I can't distinguish her features, but I can hear her silky voice as she says my name. That's all, just my name. Pharaoh. She named me, and she could have picked Edward Nathaniel Keene after my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, all the men in a long legacy before me, but she chose differently. Apparently, she loved the old film version of The Great Gatsby, and she named me after the two lead actors. Mia Farrow, Robert Redford, and I'm a Keen. I recognize how special and unique Maximoff's name is, too.
His parents also named him after something they love, and it's why neither of us ever use our names in banter. And why I'm trying to honor whatever the hell he wants me to call him. He nods a couple times, appreciative that I told him that story. A dunk of fry and mustard. Anything else?
If I asked about medical school, you'd tell me?
That you have to be more specific. I pop a fry in my mouth.
For someone who completed all 4 years, you have to like medicine at least a little bit, right?
There are people who suffered through med school, but I wasn't one of them. I slide the mustard aside and grab the glass ketchup bottle. I enjoyed medicine, just not like my family. What do you mean?
He uses a straw to push the ice in his soda. I unscrew the bottle.
It's not just about medicine for them. My father, my grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather all share the same name and the same profession. I pour ketchup in the French fry basket. There's status and pride in continuing this legacy and obtaining the MD, and I really couldn't care less about honoring a generational tradition. Why not just be a doctor for you and say fuck them? Well, that's why I finished medical school. I wiped my hands on a napkin. I genuinely wanted to help people, but every day I thought about how I was another Keen falling obediently in line, and I just couldn't breathe. I remember doing rounds in med school and feeling wrong, like out of body. I rake my fingers through my hair, like I was experiencing someone else's life that wasn't supposed to be mine. Maximoff nods. He's a good listener. He always looks interested in what people have to say, at least when he's not staring off into space. There's a possibility, I tell him, that I only liked medicine because it's all I knew. It's what I was conditioned to do. And I can honestly say it's the only thing that's ever terrified me. He thinks for a second before asking,
so how'd you decide that security detail was the right fit?
I'd been taking MMA classes for years at Studio 9. Akar suggested I'd try security training. I liked it. Maximoff is quiet for an even longer moment. You can say it. I'm not easily offended. He leans forward some.
So, you like the fame without being famous? The fine dining, the yacht trips?
Me? I give him a look. I was born to an aristocratic lineage of pretentious assholes. I didn't need to guard a celebrity to get a 5-star meal. He begins to smile.
Then why do you like it? What'd you tell me yesterday about security work?
This profession is notorious for inducing 3 things. Maximoff nods, remembering what I said. Sobriety, celibacy, and sleeplessness. He gestures to my chest.
Why put up with that weird hours, isolation, inconsistent days, and sleepless nights?
For your life, I say. I'm here to protect you. And I love being put in high-stress situations and coming out on top. Wearing a white coat isn't the only way to impact a life. My father never understood that. He's speechless. Maximoff keeps swallowing, and he turns his head, a smile forming. You're grinning, I point out. Shut up. He says flatly, and then rubs his jaw, looking right at me. We're so different. I know. He has enough siblings and cousins to create their own flag football team. I have one older stepsister who lives halfway across the country. I see her maybe once every 3 years, if that. And it's something deeper. I know how his family is a life force that keeps him breathing and waking up in the morning. Mine was suffocating me. I made a career decision at the cost of hurting my father. Maximoff would probably sooner fall to his death than betray his. Where I go rogue, he stays loyal. I recall a brief conversation we had a few days ago. He told me that he didn't go through with the Batman tattoo because it'd kill his dad. Everyone knows that Lauren Hale is a diehard Marvel fanboy, and Maximoff cares about hurting him over a tattoo. I don't know how you can care so emphatically about your parents, I tell him. Maximoff outstretches his arm. They've given me everything. I don't feel indebted to them, but I feel like it's my duty to pay it forward somehow. Some damn way. I lean back on my chair legs again. Like taking over your family's companies? Fizzle, Hale Co., Cobalt Inc., or multi-billion-dollar family businesses that their parents inherited. Then they created their own conglomerations, Callaway Couture, Hallway Comics, Superheroes and Scones, Cobalt Diamonds, Camp Callaway. The list goes on and on. The Hale-related businesses could one day be passed down to Maximoff, and that'd be his life. If I could take over Hale Co., I wouldn't a heartbeat, he says. but my dad, for whatever reason, says no on a daily basis. Good. Lauren Hale is keeping Moffy 22 and not aging him to 50, and since Maximoff collects responsibility like it's his favorite toy, I doubt he'd recognize that. Maximoff sits